This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Did you get a flu shot last year? Now, can you remember what time of the day you got it? Now, it might seem trivial, but hear me out here. Because earlier this year, scientists in the UK concluded that a flu shot in the morning may actually be more effective than the same vaccine given in the afternoon. Same dose, different time of day, seemed to make a difference in the body's response to the vaccine. Some real-world evidence that our internal circadian clocks seem to affect our immunity. And this week, another study adds weight to that conclusion by showing that time of day appears to affect the severity of a herpes virus infection, too, at least for mice. Rachel Edgar is an author on that study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. She's a research associate in the Institute for Metabolic Science, University of Cambridge in the UK, and she joins us from the BBC in London. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good afternoon, Ira. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Fill us in on what you did here. You infected mice with the herpes virus at different times of the day, and then what?
We did. So we actually used a natural mouse herpes virus. So that's quite important because you want the kind of viral immune evasion strategies and the response, the host immune response to the virus to be kind of all in play. And we took the mouse herpes virus. We infected mice at two different times of day, either at the onset of their rest period, which is in the morning for these nocturnal animals, or at the onset of their active period, which is at night for these animals. And then what we did, we used a kind of transgenic version of this virus that actually encodes a protein that emits light, and we were able to then image these mice over the course of the infection, which is about 10 days, and we were able to track both the amount of infection that we were seeing and also how well it spread throughout the body of the mouse.
Mm. And so you found out that when you gave the mice the virus, at what time of day it did what?
So we had about a tenfold increase in the amount of virus when it was administered in the morning, which is the onset of the rest period for the mouse, compared to when we administered it in the evening. And we also found that it spread more effectively when it was administered at that time as well.
Was that surprising? Tenfold increase?
Yes, I was quite surprised that it was that dramatic, because obviously the dosing was the same. And as a control for that, we took mice which have disrupted circadian clocks. We've knocked out a gene called BMAL1, which is a key clock component. And those mice have no circadian rhythms. And what we see with those mice is that when we infect them at different times, it no longer matters what time we infect them. You see high levels of infection across the day at that point.
So then the circadian rhythm then obviously has some influence on the mice's immune system.
It does. There have been quite a lot of recent studies looking at this, looking at how the circadian clock interacts with the immune system. And they do seem to find that at the onset of activity, the immune system is primed for attack, whereas at the onset of rest, it kind of can undergo regeneration and repair at that point. But so we think that's definitely a component of what we're seeing.
Right.
But something that people maybe aren't so aware of is, as well as, is that every single cell in your body has a molecular clock. Every single cell in your body can tell the time using its clock. And viruses need to infect cells in order to replicate. And what we additionally went on to do was just to take cells outside of the body, so there's no immune system at that point, and infect those cells at different times of day. And we see a similar pattern of a variation in how well the virus replicates over the time of day. So it looks to be that every cell in your body could potentially be contributing to this time of day effect we see on infection, not just the immune response to that infection.
Wow, I've never heard about that. You know, you hear about the body, but not individual cells. Okay. How much of this can we extrapolate to people from you working in mice?
So this is where it gets slightly more complicated, because what you have in the body is you have a central clock in the brain, and that sets the time and coordinates the clocks in all of your different peripheral tissues. In mice and in humans, the central clock is set at the same time in those two organisms, but how those central clocks then set the peripheral clocks is inverted, it's opposite. Because mice are nocturnal, so they have different challenges to us at night. And because it's inverted in peripheral tissues such as your nose, your airways, your skin, so places where viruses are initially going to infect, what we think is likely is that people would have a more severe infection if they're infected at the onset of their rest period at night. And actually, the study you mentioned in the introduction there goes some way to support that, because what you see with the vaccination in the morning is you see a stronger immune response to that vaccination, and that vaccination is just an inactivated influenza virus particle, basically. So if you get a stronger immune response in the morning, you're likely to get less severe disease. So it correlates quite nicely with our study.
Hmm. Is there some evolutionary reason why the immune system might vary in vigilance over a 24-hour period?
So, as I said, this is something that's under investigation. The immune system, maintaining an immune system that you want it to be able to respond no matter what, but it's very costly with regards to energy, the energy it takes up. So actually, there is probably some evolutionary benefit in having an immune system that can be more poised for attack when you're more likely to encounter diseases. So when you're just about to be all active, as opposed to continuously having it on a state of high alert.
Well, this evidence about the time of day being important for getting vaccinations, does it suggest we need to test drugs for the best time they should be taken?
I would suggest that's a very good idea. There is a kind of an emerging consensus that we should employ chronotherapies, is the term. So using the therapies we have more effectively, depending on our body clocks. And this has actually been trialled for chronic diseases. It's been trialled for cancer drugs. And so if you administer the exact same drugs that we already have, but you administer them at specific times when the body is best able to utilise them, you do see a marked increase in their efficacy. So yes, I would suggest this is a very good idea to trial this in antivirals, and I think it's something we're hoping to look at in the future.
Let's talk about the virus, the herpes virus itself. It's a very really interesting and tricky virus, and an ancient one too, and it's very widespread throughout the animal kingdom, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So it is. It's a very, very ancient virus, which of course means it's been co-evolving with us. It's probably the common ancestor of all the herpes viruses is probably about 570 million years ago or so. So before the emergence of vertebrates. So we're talking about an incredibly ancient virus. I would say the lowest organism that it's a herpes virus-like particle has been discovered in is Pacific oysters. And that was 2005. They discovered a herpes virus infecting oysters.
Wow. So it's amazing. A few months back, we talked about a very interesting study that said amyloid plaques might be the body's way of responding to infection in the brain, and that years later might lead to Alzheimer's. And the herpes virus was one of the possible infections they referred to as a possible culprit. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, certainly there's... what herpes simplex virus, which is the virus that normally causes cold sores, what that does is, like all herpes viruses, it establishes a persistent infection in the body. And it does this in peripheral nerves, so nerves in our peripheral tissues, generally. And then from there, periodically reactivates. Now, in a very small number of cases, about 1,500 per year in the States, you get a central nervous system severe infection where you get a lot of inflammation. That's called encephalitis. Now, what they think might be going on with Alzheimer's is that... herpes virus, as you age, it's more likely to spread to the brain, not in that kind of very severe way that you see with encephalitis, but it spreads to the same parts where you see kind of degeneration with Alzheimer's, so the frontal lobes and the hippocampus. And so this was kind of maybe one of the first clues, is that encephalitis, this severe herpes infection in the brain, and Alzheimer's, it's the same regions of the brain that are affected. And it's interesting. So you see an approximately kind of a 12 times increased risk if you have herpes virus infection in the brain, if you have a very specific genetic susceptibility to it anyway. So there's kind of an interaction between your genes and your environment, in this case your infection status. And there's definitely an immune component to this, an inflammatory component to this. Obviously, if you've got a low-level activation of the herpes virus, the immune system will respond to that, and the response is inflammation. And this is thought to be then contributory to the cognitive degeneration that you see with Alzheimer's. Mm.
Do you have a lot of respect for herpes virus?
I do. I'm a big fan. I know I probably shouldn't say that, but they are... they're a fascinating pathogen because, as I said, they've evolved with us over such a long period of time. What you see is these amazing kind of immune evasion strategies. They're very sneaky. They are able to counter what the immune system throws at them and subvert the immune system so that they are able to persist for a lifetime. And as I said, they have many interesting strategies to do this, and we're only really scratching the surface. I know with our study, we found that the herpes virus was actually able to manipulate the clock. So it wasn't just the virus went in at a time of day and that was that into the cell. We actually found that it attempted at all times to manipulate the clock, and it was just how successful it was in doing that. So it tried to shift the clock to an active phase, which is pretty astounding, really.
Yeah.
Given you're only talking about 100 genes per within the virus, it's a pretty complete takeover.
well, Dr. Edgar, you've given us something to think about this weekend. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very
much. Rachel Edgar at the University of Cambridge in the UK. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the spooky physics behind a new thriller novel called Dark Matter. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. I read a novel this week called Dark Matter, and the main character is a guy named Jason Dessen. Now, Jason's in his 40s. He's a loving husband and father. He teaches physics at a local community college, and once upon a time, he had a promising research career. That was before the demands of family and fatherhood intervened. You know that story. It sounds like the plot of a lot of novels. Except Jason Dessen is also a prize-winning scientist. He's single. He's a rock star in his field. And he just invented a miraculous machine, a portal to other universes. So how can both Jason Dessens exist? Well, that's easy in Dark Matter, because it's a thriller set in the multiverse. You know what the multiverse is. It's a world composed of a lot of different universes where everything that can happen to Jason Dessen, or lots of Jason Dessens, does happen. Blake Crouch is the author of Dark Matter. He joins me from Los Angeles to talk about writing a thriller based on spooky physics. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here, Ira.
Are you the real Blake Crouch, or just one of many Blake Crouch?
I'm one of many Blake Crouches. Another version of me got lost in traffic trying to get to the studio, and we're just in dead airspace.
Well, you play a lot with that in the novel. It's fascinating. You've been, I understand, obsessed with quantum physics for like a decade or more?
I have. Full disclosure, I took as few science and math courses as possible in college. So when I unfortunately stumbled upon quantum mechanics and fell instantly in love with this field of science, I was immediately intimidated and terrified of writing this idea. I have such respect for science that I wanted to represent the concepts as truthfully and with as much integrity as I could. And that meant I had no idea what I was talking about for at least 10 years and had to read articles and talk to people and try to wrap my head around it.
That's what I do. Shh, that's what I do too. did you have a role model in your writing career who you tried to emulate?
Michael Crichton was and is a big hero of mine. I came to him later in my writing life through Jurassic Park, I would assume as many people did. And what I loved about what Crichton did is that he took what would seem ostensibly to be hard science, something like chaos theory and DNA manipulation, and made it so accessible for the masses. And what I realized is that he was also not afraid to just pursue things that interested him. And when I read things like Prey and Jurassic Park and more of his catalog, it freed me up. I thought, well, I love quantum mechanics. Maybe I don't have a hard science degree, but I'm going to pursue this. I'm going to try to find out as much as I can. And if I can find a great story, write something that will appeal to so many people. Because I think what quantum mechanics actually says about the world or the illusion of reality that we see is so profound and so impactful that anyone who actually understands what it means can't help but be obsessed, I am.
Yeah, you can see that. I know reading Dark Matter, you can feel how much fun you're having explaining this stuff. And even though it's a thriller novel, I noticed that you're looking for opportunities to throw in quantum mechanics, like Schrodinger's cat is even in there.
Of course. Well, Schrodinger's cat is the conceit of the book. Instead of a cat, I basically wanted to put a human being in the Schrodinger's cat thought experiment.
So instead of a cat, we have a person.
We have a person. And one of the challenges with doing that was, so Schrodinger's cat, for your listeners who don't know, is this thought experiment that was originally intended to disprove, well, not disprove, but show how counterintuitive quantum mechanics is. You have a cat in a box with a source of radiation, an atom that has a 50% chance of decaying or not decaying. And if it decays, it breaks this vial of poison which kills the cat. And because in quantum mechanics, subatomic particles exist in multiple states, some would say multiple realities, that atom, if it has a 50-50 chance, is both decaying and not decaying at the same time. And because the fate of the cat is linked to this atom, it is alive and dead at the same time until we open the box.
Hmm. And your character then, like Schrodinger's cat, is involved in a multiverse. In other words, you've taken the idea of multiple universes, and your character has invented a machine that allows him to go into all these multiverses at the same time, making sort of copies of himself.
Exactly. Making copies of himself is an unintended consequence that perhaps wasn't fully thought through by my character, which becomes a really fun plot element deeper into the book. But he invented this box that essentially puts a human being in a state of superposition. And as I was building the box, I wanted it to be as plausible as possible. Of course, it doesn't work. If it worked, I would have won the Nobel Prize. So I built the box as thoroughly as I possibly could, and then I presented it to a guy named Clifford Johnson, who consulted with me on this book and is head of the USC physics department. And I asked him to poke holes in it and tell me where I had missed the boat, where I had gone off into left field.
Hmm. You know, the version of Jason that invents this box, this portal to the multiverse, he's kind of an evil scientist, isn't he, that version of Jason?
I don't ever think of any of my characters as evil. I think every one of my characters is the hero of their own story. But he is driven and blinded by ambition, I would say. The Jason who invented the box made a very critical choice 15 years before the events of Dark Matter begin. He decided that instead of staying with this woman, Daniela, who he had met, and they'd had this crazy, just supernova chemical attraction, But instead of staying with her and making this life with her, he was going to go off and pursue science and spend hours in the lab and basically make that his life's ambition. And I think that by the time he creates the box, while he is incredibly fulfilled in his career, he looks back, like many of us do, I think, if we're honest with ourselves, and sees this other life out there that he walked away from that could have been his. And I think it stings. And so he does a very, very bad thing.
And the book is really a page-turner. But did you worry that explaining all this physics stuff would slow down the action?
I was so worried about it. It's why it took so long to write the book. The first draft had so much more in the way of a science explanations. The first draft had actual diagrams of dimensionality. And my editor wisely said, we actually shouldn't have this in the pages. It might possibly turn people off if they flip to this page and think it's a science text. So I was trying to find a balance between keeping the pages flying along, because that's my first concern, is with keeping the reader thoroughly engaged. But also, I wanted to be true to the science. I mean, quantum mechanics is so counterintuitive. It's such a challenge to wrap our brains around. But I love that. It's mysterious, and I didn't want to dumb it down.
Do you think that quantum physics is finding, interest by the public? I mean, I can imagine you pitching this idea to your editor and saying, I want to write a book that's going to be based on quantum mechanics.
Well, it's funny. I didn't pitch it to anyone. I just wrote it because I knew if I just pitched the idea of, hey, I've got this amazing thriller that's based on the foundation of how subatomic particles behave, everyone would just fall asleep at the end of my pitch. But I knew how to write it, so what I did is I just wrote the first 150 pages and made everyone fall in love with it. And then when they asked me what was going on, I said, well, it's quantum mechanics, and just trust me, it's going to work.
Did you ever talk to Nick Payne at all, who wrote Constellations, which was sort of, was on Broadway with Jake Gyllenhaal and Ruth Wilson. It was sort of living in the multiverse the same way your characters are?
No, I didn't. I never did. Oh, that sounds fascinating, though.
Yeah, I really love the way you were able to get around the most critical part of quantum mechanics, which is the act of observation collapses all the other worlds, right? You're left with the world we have, but you created a drug that Jason takes that prevents his mind from actually observing it, right? So the worlds are all there.
Exactly. I mean, the box, as I was building it, had two things that needed to be solved. The first thing that needed to be solved was exterior stimuli coming into the box and destroying the quantum state. And I mean, beyond the external observation, things like cosmic rays and neutrinos can pass through almost anything and in theory would make a quantum state impossible, which is why you may notice that I never say what substance the box is built of. And that was the recommendation of my physics consultant, because he said, once you say that, everyone's going to flip out and start attacking the plausibility. So I never say what the substance the box is made of is. But the bigger concern is that once my human or my cat is inside the box, they are still observing. And one of the tenets of quantum mechanics is that observation creates reality. And so they're observing themselves and they're interacting with the quantum state inside the box. So the way I got around that was I had my main character have a friend who was a neuroscientist and who developed this mysterious psychoactive drug which locked down certain parts of the prefrontal cortex, which I say, because here's where I get to take some artistic license, cause or are responsible for our power of observation. And once those are shut down, once the box is sealed, I couldn't find any reason why I couldn't say a character was in a state of superposition.
Yeah, you're the cat inside the box.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, different science writers have different rules that they lay out for themselves where they can stretch the science and how far they're going to go with it. Do you have your own rules about that?
I don't have rules to the extent that anything is written down. When I start, what's most important to me is finding a field of science that I'm interested in. It comes back to my admiration for Michael Crichton, finding a sense of the science that I'm interested in and wanting to talk about that and wanting to educate myself. And I think out of that respect comes some subconscious rules. For instance, I want everything in my books to at least be plausible, something that maybe we figure out in 20 or 40 or 50 years. And the only difference is, well, in my books, there's been some jump that's been made that allows it to happen now.
You know, I noticed you missed an opportunity for a spooky action at a distance in the book.
Ooh, please tell me.
Well, think about it. You had how many different Jasons did you have by the end? You had dozens and dozens of different Jasons. Couldn't they all have been entangled and knew exactly what each other was doing at the same time?
Well, I did sneak entanglement into the book, but I didn't hang too big of a lantern on it because I thought it would be a little over the top cheesy. But if you think about it, the relationship between Jason and his wife, Daniela, is, he even describes it in this letter he writes to her as he's trying to find home. And he says, you know, we're all matter. We're all made in the fires of dead stars. And he describes that their connection is so powerful and so inexplicable to him. It's almost as if their matter was entangled, billions and billions of years ago. That was my nod to entanglement.
I gotcha. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Blake Crouch, author of Dark Matter, a great little summer read if you're looking for something for the rest of the year to take to the beach or to enjoy. It goes by very quickly. You'll like it. Is there anything left for you to talk about in the next novel you might be looking at? Or are you done with quantum mechanics for a while?
I am probably done with quantum mechanics for a while. I feel like I have lived in that world for more than a decade, and I'm really interested to dig in on something new that piques my curiosity. In fact, that's where I'm at right now in terms of figuring out my next book. I'm reading a bunch of articles. I'm scouring the scientific landscape of emerging technologies, looking for that special thing that just checks the box in my head that makes me want to dive in and
spend
a few years.
I know what it is.
Oh, tell me.
It's CRISPR.
CRISPR?
You know what CRISPR is?
No, I've never heard of it.
Oh, CRISPR is the latest technology to edit genes. You can splice and dice genes. You can, they're even talking about creating life forms now, synthetic life forms. With this tool, and you can mix and match genes and things.
CRISPR. Wow.
CRISPR.
I'll look that up. I will say I'm fascinated by 4D printing.
I know 3D. What's 4D?
4D printing is creating a substance that can self-assemble, but can also react to its environment long after its initial creation. So in other words, you're adding the dimension of time to a substance that allows it to, for instance, a pipe that responds to water flow, to temperature, and can actually change and mold to fit the environment. I have no idea if I'll use it or where that goes, but that's the sort of thing that catches my interest, and I'll just try to read everything I can about it.
What do you do when you write it? Do you work out the science part first or the storyline?
Well, for instance, in Dark Matter, it started with the science because I knew that I had to have enough of a grasp on quantum mechanics to even be in the conversation. But while I was doing all of that research, I was also actively searching for that next story idea, which I could marry to the science. And I had three story ideas occur to me over this 10-year stretch when I was trying to, break quantum mechanics for myself. One of which was a man is lost in time. One of which is a man meets himself and what happens then. And the other was the idea of a box, but it wasn't the box in terms of the superposition. It was just the strange box, and I knew I wanted someone to go inside, and I didn't know what happened after. But I loved the image of a box in a hangar with lights beating down on it, and it's deep underground in a lab. I tried to write each of these ideas on my own, in isolation rather, and they always petered out because no one was big enough to support the full structure of a novel. And 2 years ago, I was in Chicago and trying to figure out what my next book was going to be. And I suddenly, it was just like a lightning bolt moment where I saw how all of these three ideas fit together like puzzle pieces into the structure of dark matter. And I already had the quantum mechanics broken at that point, and I was off
there
and running.
Well, if you understood quantum mechanics, you're ahead of a lot of all of us. Blake Crouch is author of the thriller Dark Matter. It's a great read. He's also author of the Wayward Pines trilogy. He joined us from L.A. And you can read an excerpt of Dark Matter at sciencefriday.com/darkmatter. Thank you, Blake.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good luck with the book. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to have the space race meeting Silicon Valley after this. Don't go away. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. There's a new space race afoot. Now, you may not have heard of it because, well, we're not in the middle of an old Cold War, and NASA isn't even a key player in this race. Today's space race is taking place among small private companies racing to build tiny rockets. Why? Tim Fernholz knows. He's a reporter for Quartz Magazine and the author of a forthcoming book about the business of space. Tim, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
You're welcome. What's behind the race to build small rockets?
Well, it's the same things that are driving a lot of the fun technological improvements in our lives, and it starts with miniaturization. A lot of people have smartphones, and that's just kind of the concrete evidence that we can put a really powerful computer in a very light package.
So they're building tiny little satellites?
Well, the same principles apply. What used to be maybe a 500-pound, a one-ton satellite is now maybe 100 pounds. Maybe it's 5 pounds for CubeSats that weigh just a few kilograms. And as people are seeing what these small satellites can do, they're getting ideas about what they can do in orbit. The big obstacle for doing any kind of business in orbit above Earth is getting stuff up there. It costs tens of thousands of dollars per pound. Mm-hmm. But now the satellites are getting small enough and new space companies are promising low enough launch costs that Silicon Valley investors are throwing hundreds of millions of dollars at satellite businesses that people would have thought were crazy a decade ago.
Wow. So who are the major players here?
So on the rocket side, you have a company called Vector Space, you have another called Firefly, you have a company called Rocket Labs, and you also have Richard Branson, the UK billionaire, whose company Virgin Galactic is also developing a rocket that fires from a plane that will launch small satellites into space.
I thought you were just in the tourism business.
You know, the tourism business is not going so well. They're having a hard time getting that rocket off the ground. And really, they're looking at this new surge of small satellites and saying, oh, well, this is something that we can do and make a buck on.
How big a rocket is a small rocket?
So the Vector Space rocket or the Virgin Galactic rocket, those are going to be 40 feet, 60 feet long, which is pretty big. I mean, yeah. But when you think about a SpaceX rocket is 14 stories tall, or the new SLS rocket that NASA is building to send people to the moon is even bigger than that. These are small for rockets.
So are the SpaceX people watching and saying, hey, maybe we could get into that business too?
Yes and no. What's funny about SpaceX is when they originally started their company in 2002, this is what they thought they would do. They were going to build a small rocket and launch small satellites, and that was going to be great. But then they succeeded in building the rocket, and no one wanted to buy it from them. No one wanted to hire them. There wasn't a market. So they were like, forget this. Let's build a big one.
Right.
In the process, they did that. They lowered the cost so much that all of a sudden, there's a lot more demand. And suddenly, now there are people who are building small satellites who will get who've convinced these new companies to step into the mm-hmm. role of launching them. But now SpaceX and other competitors like Boeing and Lockheed's joint venture, ULA, they're like, oh, we're going to have to figure out how to do this too. So they're developing new special racks to carry lots of small satellites. And they're working with companies that are like ride sharing for space, who are kind of brokers for all of these small satellite entrepreneurs with these big expensive rockets.
Speaking of ride sharing, I guess you can call these other companies the Uber.
I certainly have.
Right, sure. So why, if you want to build a small satellite, what are the pros and cons of choosing the big guys versus the new startup companies?
So all of these big guys are based around an economic model of putting really huge, heavy satellites very, very high up in the air. And so this new business model of having a lot of tiny satellites pretty low in space it just doesn't jibe, and they end up kind of being just tagging along on these missions up to space. They don't really get to pick when they launch. Mm. They don't get to pick how they launch. There's no flexibility. So it's a hassle, and they also have to wait 14 months, 18 months to get up into space, which if you're a Silicon Valley person and you want to iterate and you want to break things and fail fast, 18 months is an eternity. So if they can find a solution where they launch in just 1 month, then they have an opportunity to compete, perhaps.
You know, being you mentioned Silicon Valley, Silicon Valley is a place where people raid each other's companies for intellectual property ideas and smart people. Is that happening in the rocket building business also? It's
a very close-knit world. You know, on the Vector Space team, there are former SpaceX people. Two former SpaceX executives are heading up Virgin Galactic's Launcher One program. So there's a lot of people going back and forth. But because it's such a small community, I mean, yes, there is a sort of competition and a sense of backbiting and don't steal my engineers. But everybody knows everybody. And a lot of these people now, you have to remember that this private space sector that's taking off right now did not exist 5 or 10 years ago. And these guys were kind of nerds shooting off rockets in the desert for amateur purposes, you know, working in the space industry, never doing what they really wanted to do. And now all of a sudden there's a bonanza and they think, oh, my God, we're going to build a rocket company.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know that they are these amateur rocket contests and expos every year. And these are pretty big rockets and they do sort of go up there. I mean, these are the people who are building these.
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny, United Launch Alliance, their interns just launched the world's largest sport rocket, which is just like that. It's like an amateur rocket. Some of them go up to suborbital height, so maybe 80 kilometers in the sky. These companies want to do something a little bit more ambitious, a little harder to do, but they have the funding and they think they have the market for it.
Wait, was there a turning point for all of this that you can point to?
It's hard to pick a single moment, but it really is SpaceX coming in and breaking up what had been kind of a military-industrial complex. The rocket companies in the U.S. had NASA contracts and Air Force contracts that, frankly, were bloated with billions of dollars. SpaceX came in and disrupted that market, took a huge chunk of the market share, and everybody else in Silicon Valley is saying, oh, hey, we can do that too, maybe.
Do I have to get a license to launch a rocket?
You do. Above a certain height, a certain size, but the FAA actually had to start an Office of Commercial Space Transportation, and now the FAA will approve these flights.
So is there enough room up there in space for all of these little satellites that people want to put up?
Well, yes and no. I mean, space is quite big, and I would encourage anyone who's listening to go to Quartz, go to our website, QZ.com. We have a satellite map that puts this in perspective. Space is quite big. There's room. There are two companies right now that are helping drive this. One is OneWeb. The other is actually SpaceX's satellite division. Both of those companies want to launch literally 700 satellites each to provide broadband internet service to the world. So that's a huge glut of satellites that need to go up there. And that would almost, consider there are 1,300 active satellites in the world right now, that would almost double it.
Wow.
So it's going to be an issue of coordination and planning and getting everybody on the right spot. There's still a lot of room, but people are worried about space debris right now.
Yeah.
There's little broken chunks of dead satellites, screws from the ISS flying around. And some scientists are worried that if there's like a chain reaction like in the movie Gravity, it could be very bad for orbit.
Is there one kind of satellite the new companies want to put up that there's a demand for?
I wouldn't say there's one kind, except in the sense that a lot of them use what are called CubeSats, and those weigh maybe, you know, 5 to 10 pounds. There's a company that's now called Planet, used to be called Planet Labs. They are going to operate the largest Earth observation constellation of satellites. There are a bunch of guys who started off at NASA and started this company. And so CubeSats are kind of the lingua franca of the small satellite world, I think.
Fascinating, Tim. Thank you. Yeah. Fascinating. Tim Fernholz is a reporter for Quartz Magazine. Niku is the Chinese word for rebellious, and that's the name scientists have given to a new space object that marches to the beat of its own drum, more specifically, its own orbit. Earlier this month, scientists discovered Niku's orbital plane is tilted by 110 degrees to the sun. That's passed straight up, and it's traveling a path that's practically perpendicular to every other object in the solar system. What's even weirder is that it also moves around the sun backwards. There's only one other known object with a similar orbit in the entire solar system, and that's called Drac, which was discovered in 2008, and scientists are still looking for a way to explain that peculiar object. Well, joining me now to talk about this is a man who is no stranger to unsolved mysteries of the universe. His research is focused on the hunt for the elusive Planet Nine. Konstantin Batygin is assistant professor of planetary science at Caltech. Konstantin, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So what is NICU?
NICU is, a piece of icy debris that resides beyond the orbit of Neptune. It's probably about 150 kilometers across, or the size of L.A. and Orange County combined. And, from the point of view of its physical properties, right, it's a relatively typical Kuiper Belt object, but its orbit is truly what's exciting about this new body. Like you said, it orbits on its side. Pretty weird.
On its side. It's at 110 degrees orbiting on its side. So its axes are tilted, so to speak?
That's right, yeah. So if you were to draw the solar system, any third grader will draw the solar system kind of on a piece of paper as a bunch of concentric circles. This object comes out of the piece of paper kind of almost in the perpendicular sense, except for it's a little bit worse than that. It's tilted in the wrong way. It's not just taking some of these circles and putting them out of the plane. It's putting them out of the plane by more than 90 degrees.
And so it comes from the Kuiper Belt. Tell us more about the Kuiper Belt. Is that where Drac also comes from?
That's exactly right. So the Kuiper Belt is just a name given to this field of icy debris that all live beyond the orbit of Neptune. One of the more famous members of the Kuiper Belt is Pluto. In fact, Pluto was the original Kuiper Belt object, and what led to its demotion was the discovery of the remainder of these other objects. So in any case, the Kuiper Belt, typically has orbital periods of order hundreds of years, maybe 200-300, and NICU falls exactly in that regime. Its orbital period is almost 200 years. So there's nothing kind of out of the ordinary about it, except for its orbital plane, right? Its orbital plane is totally messed up.
And I know that you're a Planet Nine aficionado. That strange, who knows where it is, planet out there.
Oh, I know where it is.
You do? Where is it?
I'm pointing to it right now.
I see that. But Drac and NICU are the same kind of planet. Does Planet Nine then inform you about why these planets have such a weird orbit?
So interestingly, these guys are too close to Neptune to be affected by Planet Nine as their orbits are right now. Right now, they live in the part of the solar system where Planet Nine's influence cannot be seen. In fact, most of the known solar system is a region where Planet Nine's gravitational influence cannot be felt. For example, the Earth's orbit is not affected by it either. So these guys don't necessarily tell us anything direct about Planet Nine. Could Planet Nine have played a role in their formation? Maybe. I don't want to sound like a broken record and sort of, blame everything on Planet Nine, but it's something that we could hypothesize. But the remarkable thing about Drac and NICU is that we really don't understand where they came from. It's a totally open question. We don't have a mechanism to produce these types of orbits.
Wow. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Konstantin about Batygin, about Planet Nine and these really weird couple of planets, NICU and Drac. Could it be, and I'm going to push you a little bit on this, could it be that Planet Nine, that strange planet, pushed these guys into that strange orbit, kicked them out somehow?
Yeah, I mean, I want to say, that I'm not saying it was Planet Nine, but between you and me, it was totally Planet Nine. So it's a great question. Is it a reasonable thing to speculate about? Absolutely. Planet Nine, we know that Planet Nine modifies the inclinations, the orbital planes of objects that are further out, right? Mm-hmm. About maybe a factor of five or maybe seven further out than Niku and Drac. Could it be that the origin story for Niku and Drac is they used to be further out, the plane got tilted, and then by getting scattered by Neptune, its orbit sort of shrunk? Is that a reasonable story? I think it's a perfectly reasonable story to investigate. I don't have calculations to, you know, support what I'm saying. So this is just, I'm just making this up as I go.
We gotcha. I do that a lot. We said the orbit was tilted 110 degrees. That means it's gone past being normal, being perpendicular.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Is Drac doing the same thing? Do we know how? I'm trying to visualize that.
Yeah, so Drac is not quite as extreme. Drac's inclination is 100 degrees, not 110, but it's in the same exact ballpark, right? The orbits are tilted, and they're tilted by sort of a very similar angle, which is remarkable. So this is one of these things pop up in the solar system every few years or so, where we, you know, think we have it figured out pretty well, and then a new object comes up, and we recognize that there's this whole population of objects that we didn't understand. We don't know the origin story for these things, and that typically leads to some added information and some added insight, which informs the very formation of our own solar system in the first place.
So there should be more of these weird planets.
Absolutely. I think that you know, we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg here, right? Drac was that very first object discovered back in 2008. The fact that there are now two informs us of the fact that this is a real population. These are not two flukes that happen to have very similar orbital planes. This is a real population, and we need to figure out where it comes from.
I mistakenly called them planets. I'm just assuming they're trans-Neptunian objects, right?
Right. So,
TNO.
I mean, these are smallish asteroid-type bodies.
Yeah. Well, we're hoping that you find more, Constantine, so you can come back and tell us more about these weird things.
Yeah, we'll get to work.
And hope you'll provide us the exact location of Planet 9 soon, I'm sure.
You can bet on it.
Team Batygin is Assistant Professor of Planetary Science at Caltech. Good luck in your quest.
Thank you very much.
That's about all the time we have for Searching for Planet 9. BJ Lindemann composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. One last thing, if you're looking for a good book to pick up this weekend, there's still time to join our reading list. We're reading Margaret Atwood's apocalyptic sci-fi tale, Oryx and Crake. That's our sci-fi book club, which wraps up next week. More about the book, the science behind the book, and even an adult coloring book page. Yeah, all on our website, sciencefriday.com/bookclub. Lots of stuff to read this weekend. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.